Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Go to Amy Englehart's website, and what hits you right away is a question. Who the hell? Amy suggests getting something to drink while you peruse the site. That's not a bad idea, because you can be there a while as she answers that question. Allow me to provide a brief synopsis. Amy is a composer, lyricist, singer, teacher, all-around talented, creative, very funny, irreverent artist. From 1998 to 2011, she was the only female of and primary writer-arranger for The Bobs, the Grammy-nominated vocal band without instruments. They toured everywhere, New York, L.A., Liechtenstein. Amy recently made her off-Broadway debut with the sold-out run of Bastard Jones, which was a finalist for the Richard Rodgers Award for New Musicals, the Eugene O'Neill Theater Conference, and the Alec Baldwin Fellowship. There's a whole list of other theatrical works, too numerous to mention in this introduction. And speaking of lists, there's also her work as a session and concert singer, and includes Jurassic World, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Jim Henson's Animal Jam. I also want to mention Tune In Time, New York City's musical theater game show that she created in 2014. Amy was the recipient of the Berman Award for Songwriting from the Manhattan Association of Cabarets, a 2012 MAC Award nomination for Special Musical Material, and 3 2012 Broadway World Cabaret nominations. Amy graduated from Syracuse University and the Berklee College of Music. Amy, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today all the way from L.A.
Thank you, Sandy. Wow, that sounds really good, all of that, when it's presented in that way.
I think it's a whole different ballgame when you hear it as opposed to read it. So in spite of this very involved introduction, my first question to you is how to define Amy Englehart? Were you born a singer, a lyricist, a composer, a creative dynamo?
She's the living incarnation of words, music, comedy, garlic, gourmet cheese, and cats.
Okay, I guess eclectic would be an understatement, huh?
Yeah, but you know, the strange thing is someone once asked me about the fact that I did so many things. They said, well, your resume is eclectic and let's just say eccentric. And I said, well, the thing is, when I do all of these things, they feel like the same thing. If that makes any sense. It to me, it all comes from the same place, whether I'm writing a score or teaching improv comedy or singing a session. It kind of all comes from the same font. You know what I'm saying?
I do, because we're not talking about writing, composing, and then doing somebody's taxes.
Right, exactly. It all flows in, and I found when I started teaching that I could distill it down to a couple of basic principles that kind of applied across the board and, apply to human relationships too, because it's all about communication when you boil it down. You know, principles being try and do good,
right?
Listen, be positive, support the people you're working with, and commit.
Well, that's all very Judeo-Christian, but let's go back in time, because I really want to know, was this something you had to gotta dance? Were you encouraged? Were you mentored? Were you supported? Did you know that you had to do this because you had to?
You know, I did know, and it was always a given that Amy was going to do this. I would take sheet music books, and I would either try and play them or sing them into the double tape recorder. I would decide to sing the harmonies. I would the piano part, and you know, of course, since it was cassettes, it got faster and faster each time I sang along with myself until there were four parts on the final project, because I didn't have recording software. But when I was a kid, that's how I had fun. So, and I was doing variety shows for babysitters. God love them. And, you know, forcing my brother to act out the Donnie and Marie variety hour. But I was always the musical comedy classes, dance classes. By the time I was a teen, I was in New York every weekend running around with my teen theater geek gang, aiming for a career as a performer. I was a real academic geek, but it was always known that that's what I would do with my life. And I think that's actually the best gift my family gave me, unwavering support.
So you're taking piano lessons, you take dance lessons, you take voice lessons as you're a teenager in New Jersey?
Yes, I did. I did. And it was kind of my temple.
And so it was a religious experience.
Yes. I was one of those people who didn't have the ideal situation at home. So, you know, when I look back on it, I see that I was yearning for some kind of structure. And even though it's more of an outlet in some ways, it also has a lot of structure. Things like dance do have a lot of structure. Say, for instance, in ballet, you know if you're doing it right.
Of course.
You know,
yes.
You're either great at it or you're not, and you have to really work at it. And it gave me something immediate and tangible, at least dance did, to have results for. Of course, nothing else does in this life, music or theater. There's no tangible results or encouragement until you actually get to do something.
But you called it structure. Can I call it escape?
Yeah, I would agree wholeheartedly. Yes. I'm also a person who, in my writing, I'm a structure nut and a firm believer that you have to create structures in order to break them. And that's what makes things funny,
mm-hmm.
That's what makes things meaningful. So yeah, I would agree completely.
So you go to college, you go to Syracuse University.
Yeah, musical theater major.
And then it's a no-brainer, I would assume, that you're going to try and strike it rich in New York.
I had been writing all along, and, you know, I picked up the guitar for a while, and I was started out as a choral geek and into big band, and then I slowly wound my way into pop when I was in college. And I had a very, very strange experience in college in which I didn't get cast hardly ever. And I was always the weird choice for stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Your past guest Sheila Head and I were in college together, actually. And that's where we met, because Sheila and I were always the other two who didn't get cast.
Well, or did they just assume you guys were the funny sidekick?
Yeah, we were the funny sidekicks. But, you know, we'd come down to callbacks for the final main stage productions. And if it was a comedy or a drama, and it would come down to the person who got the role, me and Sheila. And eventually when Sheila did get cast in something, she had to drop out and they called me.
Oh, so you got it in a sense by default.
Exactly. And we laughed about this wholeheartedly. And we ended up forming an improv comedy group together called Second Choice. And what I learned through this experience was you really have to figure out what it is that you do and go be you to the maximum, because if it's not happening for you, you have to find the way to make it happen. Kind of a mirror of my personal life, as it turned out. You know, if you don't have what you need, go get it, you know. And so I did that. I started writing and I founded a cabaret series, and I was already a non-traditional person by the time I left Syracuse. I was kind of disillusioned, even though I knew I had abilities and this is what I was going to do. I wasn't sure what form it was going to take when I was at Syracuse. And I actually did work steadily afterwards as a performer. And then someone hepped me to Berkeley and said, you know, you really should do this. I think this would make you a really well-rounded musician and you should give this a shot. And I said, you know, okay.
So you go to the Berklee College of Music to hone those skills?
Yeah, I kind of put the performing on a back burner. I'd been doing it since I was a kid, and I was confused by my experience at Syracuse with kind of the smack in the face of,
right,
is this me? I'm a strange person. I don't look like an ingenue, so I'm not going to be cast as an ingenue. I sound with a classically trained voice. I'm 21, but I sound kind of more mature. I'm 21, but I'm the smartass, but I'm not getting cast. You know, it's the finding out what it is you are time.
So they couldn't categorize you.
Yes, a problem which to this day haunts me. Everything I've done has been like that. All every piece of work I do is like that.
But that only speaks to your talent, I think. And I'm not just heaping praise on you for the sake of praising you, because there is this diversity. It's not that you just are a dramatic actress, or it's not that you just sing opera, that there is this versatility that you have to embrace.
Yeah, see, go towards the weird and let your freak flag fly, because the truth is that it's flying and you can't stop it from flying. And those are the things that, even though they are challenges, that's what makes you different from anybody else. And, you know, it can be a lifelong struggle with something like that, because we live in a world that wants to label things, wants to put things in boxes, wants to know what things are. And I've always been a very and person instead of an or person. I just said it. And it leads you to very interesting places, although not everyone's going to go there with you.
So let's go on that trip together. Would you basically say 1998, when you got involved with the Bobs, which you would definitely have to explain to us where the name came from? And, I mean, what,
you know,
the hell?
If I had a dime for every time someone said, you need to explain this to me.
Well, you know what's really funny? I wonder if people thought there was a typo and that Bobs was missing a second O.
I used to make that joke all the time.
Well, great minds, okay? But talk about the genesis of this vocal band without instruments, which is another way of saying a cappella.
Yes. The Bobs were founded in 1981 in San Francisco by some out-of-work singing telegram guys who had all seen the same a cappella performance somewhere else and thought, you know, that looks like something you could do. And at the time, there was no vocal percussion. There was no beatboxing. There was nothing like that. It was, the zeitgeist was new wave. You know, it was pre MTV. And they formed this group, and they were very out in their approach to things, because one of them was a composer. One of them was a recording engineer and bass singer. They all had very different influences. And it became this kind of melting pot of their influences and a very angular approach to what they were doing. And they wanted to sound like nothing else you had heard. And they thought, what if we did very outrageous, audacious vocal covers of tunes that no one should do vocally? It's like we're part of the band, but we forgot the instruments. They were nominated for a Grammy in 1985 for their vocal arrangement of the Beatles' Helter Skelter, which is extremely deconstructionist, and you can find this online. If you heard it, you would recognize it as Helter Skelter, but it's a completely different approach.
Let me ask you this. How did you get involved with the Bobs? And again, what's the genesis of the name?
The name just came from a very timely thing. It was actually a time joke. It was supposed to be the Oral Roberts, the Oral Bobs, best of it's, it actually was one of the explanations for the name of the group. But the best one is that it's best of breed. It stands for best of breed, which is dog show term.
Okay. What, did you audition for them? Did they have a woman before you joined in 98?
Yes, the lineup had always been three men and one woman, and there's no quote-unquote lead singer. Everyone does everything. So at any given time, you'd be performing a background part that could be the function of a guitar or a piano or drums, or you'd be a lead or you'd be a harmony. So no one gets to sit down mentally. And the music is all over the place, every style, and they evolve from covers to about 90% originals. And I met the tenor in the group in 96 when I was put on a acapella Christmas caroling gig on the Seinfeld set. I was the alto, and we showed up, and he kept cracking up the soprano who contracted the group. And I thought, no, that's my job. Who is this guy? And it turned out that he was Joe, or Joe Bob, because you call each other Bob, whatever Bob in the band, from the Bobs. And I thought, huh, that's kind of interesting. He's hysterically funny. And I gleaned from the conversation that they had just replaced the woman in the group. And had I indeed known that they were replacing the woman in the group, would have been something that I would have gone after. And it sounded, however, from his conversation, like it might not work out for different reasons that were not musical. And indeed, it didn't work out, as it turned out. And over the course of that next year, I went to see them and I stayed in touch with this guy. And something in me just said, you need to stay in touch with this guy. Something about it just rang right. And indeed, when they did come back around in January 1988 and my predecessor left the group, he called me and said, will you come and audition for us? And I said, yep. And I knew exactly what they were because someone had given me a cassette while I was at Berkeley of one of their albums from 1984. And I played it like mad until I didn't play it anymore and got tired. But I never could have known, driving across the country listening to it, that's what I'd end up doing.
Well, wait, did you join them in 98 or 88?
98.
Because you said in 88.
Someone gave me a cassette in 1988 of the Bobs. In 10 years later, I actually ended up in the group.
That was not your full-time job, I'm guessing, that you were doing, in spite of the fact that you were touring with them, were you doing other creative things as well?
I was, but at its height, we were doing between 75 and 100 shows a year.
Oh, God.
In the United States and Europe, and corporate stuff and jingles and stuff like that and workshops. So this was not, as I call, a beg your friends gig. This was a, you know, we were with Columbia Artists. We had 15 albums. We toured. It was everything from vocal and jazz festivals and performing arts centers to clubs like Iridium and the Metropolitan Room eventually. In New York, we used to play the Bottom Line. That used to be our home, the late lamented Bottom Line.
Mm-hmm.
But we also played the Lincoln Center tree lighting. We did the Songbook Series, the American Songbook Series, the Toyota Comedy Festival. Like I said, either small clubs or big name events. And it was kind of the best of both worlds in that way, because it would be intimate venues, which I prefer, or giant, you know, 10,000 people, jumbotron, open air things. And it was fabulous. It was really an amazing experience. And I was one of the primary writer arrangers for the group, and I didn't have to conform to any standard of commercialism, because that's, again, basically what they are. They're in undefinable. Kind of, I came up with Manhattan Transfer meets Monty Python.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't that the music wasn't serious, because it was. It's that the presentation is not necessarily serious, although it's not quote-unquote wacky. It's the NPR version of acapella.
I listened to several of your songs. They're positively hilarious. And we're going to play a sample of How Did This Thing Get In Me? So you perform with this group. You're making money. It really seems to kind of be feeding your creative bent. And then what happens? You start to write plays or musicals or, I mean, where did that come from?
Well, I always keep an ear to the ground. You know, I'm a diehard New Yorker, East Coaster, New Jersey person, and it had been something in the back of my head that I wanted to do, and somebody approached me to write the lyrics for something in a theater company in Seattle. The Bobs were based in Seattle, so I was traveling up there a lot, and I said, what an interesting idea. I was asked to write the lyrics for a musical adaptation of Nicholas Nickleby, not the 9-hour version, and I said, what an interesting assignment. I'm not really a Dickens person, but sure, why not? And it's kind of, Nicholas Nickleby is kind of a dour piece, and they said they asked me because I had a lighter touch, and they thought that might influence where the music went, and, you know, the timbre of the presentation might change if they had someone who used words in a different way, possibly even comedic. And I had such a wonderful time doing it. This is about 2003 or 2004. That it was like walking into a room that I hadn't been in years and turning on the lights and saying, wow, why am I not sitting in this room? This feels like second nature. It feels like breathing. It I know what I'm doing. How did that happen? And so other commissions followed, and I just started writing more and more for those kinds of situations. And eventually the Bobs did a show at the Flying Karamazov Brothers that was a baby musical, and which I kind of spearheaded from our end. We're supposed to workshop it. You know, these things go down a track and then either they lift off or they don't. It didn't happen, but it became a going concern for me doing other things. And as much as I loved the Bobs, it's an up and down business, and it started kind of going into the down mode, whereas it had sustained me for so long. So I was looking for other things to do, both with my time and my focus. And I was working more in LA because financially it wasn't hitting the mark in terms of the touring, because it was, you know, it had run its course. And at a certain point you have to say, I can't reserve my time for this. I have to get involved in other things. And oddly enough, even though there is almost no financial reward for writing theater, at least initially, it was such an amazing new/old thing for me. It was like putting on comfortable shoes that got me further down the road.
So did you move back to New York?
No. Oddly enough, I did not. I have a wonderful home, husband, and cat here in LA. And my husband is based here and does film-related things. So that was not an option. But I did come back to New York for grad school immediately after leaving the Bobs, thinking it might be an option to move back there. And I went to Columbia for a year as an arts administration master's candidate, because I've done all that. I've done pretty much every job. In addition to having done every performing and creative job you could do, I've probably done every job you could do administratively for regional theaters and what have you. And I've been an agent, and I've, you know, done press stuff. So cause you kind of have to.
You were bicoastal, in other words, that you wrote out there and then you would come here to have them produced?
Yeah, they're Seattle, and I'm not in these shows anymore. These are things that I wrote with other people. I had a couple in Seattle, one in LA, and then I started to write things write projects in New York, and no interest in being in them. None. No one-woman shows. When I do perform, it's as a singer-songwriter. It's more of a cabaret thing where I just play for myself and do stuff from my own personal back catalog. But yeah, I just started doing more and more of these things, and the Bobs had run its course.
Mm-hmm.
It was great while it was a thing, but it ran its course for me financially and creatively, and I just needed to do something else, you know? And I'm forever happy and honored and proud of my demented legacy with them.
What's going on in your life? What's happening with Amy?
Well, 2017 was a kind of a amazing year. Everything flipped for me this year.
Well, you're not alone in that department, honey.
Oh, that's for sure. Yeah, politically, personally, different ends are up.
I gotcha.
In so many ways. This summer, a show that I wrote called Bastard Jones premiered off-Broadway. I did the score with my collaborator, Mark Aceto, who is one of the funniest people on the planet. He wrote the book for the Broadway musical Allegiance as well. Not a thigh slapper, but that tells you the breadth of his talent.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely amazing playwright. And we were thrilled to have that produced for many reasons, especially the fact that it's a musical comedy, rock musical comedy adaptation of Henry Fielding's Tom Jones from 1749, which is about the pursuit of happiness no matter your birth circumstances, which is, of course, an extremely relevant thing today. And in keeping with the hybrid nature of everything I do, it is a period farce with a rock score. And we had been working on this for a long time, and it was wonderful to see this come to fruition off-Broadway. And it got stellar reviews, and we sold out, and we're working towards a commercial run with that in 2018. We've signed an option agreement, so we're trying to get that happening. I continue to be extremely bi-coastal. I'm coming back to do a show at Don't Tell Mama. I'm doing house concerts in just outside of Boston and in Washington, D.C., which I do. I'm going to join the Bobs in their farewell tour. They're hanging it up this year, so I'm going to make a cameo in their New York and D.C. appearances. And the next thing I'm working on, which is why I was up all night, is a project for the New York Museum of Transit.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They have a series called Platform, in which they invite artists of every discipline and academics and engineers and whoever can come up with something to submit proposals for presentations or performances or some kinds of exhibits. And the only caveat is that they have to involve mass transit. And I thought, what a cool thing to do. And I'd been to the Museum of Transit out in Brooklyn, and they have this deconstructed bus. The seats that are on the bus, it's kind of an open air thing where kids can play in it, and the front of the bus, so you can sit and pretend you're the driver, or and the back of the bus, but it's open air. And I remembered this from when I was there about a decade ago, and I came up with a proposal called Triptych, which is a trio of 10-minute musicals set on the M42 as it crosses Manhattan from east to west. It takes place in 1985, 2000, and 2017, and we follow these three friends, both across the island and through their relationships to each other and the city. And some of it's kind of autobiographical. So in 1985, I was that theater teen running around. So it's that. It's, you know, they're 16, they're 30, and then they're 45 looking at their lives and the city and how it's changed and what 42nd Street is like and how society has changed. So it's super fun. And I've never written the book, music, and lyrics before. And I thought this would be a great chance to do that.
So in other words, as we kind of wrap this up because we're running out of time, I guess I could put words in your mouth again and say that Amy Engelhart is in a good place.
Yeah. Yeah. And I got two more projects coming up that are in completely different arenas. I'm a big fan of scaring myself. So if you want to find out more about what I'm doing, you can find me on Facebook. Engelhart is E-N-G-E-L-H-A-R-D-T, or you could go to my website, which is amyengelhart.com, and in dire need of an update. It's been that way for about 8 months, but I've had no time.
No kidding. As we say goodbye to Amy, I want to give everyone a taste of your talent, Amy. So we are going to close this show with How Did This Thing Get in Me? One of my favorite Amy Engelhart songs. And I want to thank you so much for getting up so early in the morning to have a conversation with me. I really enjoyed meeting, getting to know you. And I'm a fan, kiddo. I'm a fan.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much. And this tune actually features Harry Shearer as Joseph. And I like to think of it as my instant holiday classic. I perform this every year in his holiday shows. I usually tour with him and his wife, Judith Owen. Super fun.
It is a lot of fun. Amy, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. And let's take it out with How Did This Thing Get in Me?
The devil started when we started to talk. My husband Joseph and me went for a walk. He saw my belly and broke out in a sweat. He said,
how can you be pregnant? I ain't touched you yet.
I'd like to think I'm not the gullible type. Don't go for mal-exaggeration or hype. So when I tell you this, it's gonna sound odd, but I think that I'm the portal for the Son of God. How did this thing get in me? Only God knows if I have a man with Joseph, but apparently there's no guarantee. So how did this thing get in me? I'm educated as a shepherd's wife gets.
I know where babies come from. I got pets. And Joseph spends all his time with the sheep, but you know, I'm told that's cliche. I don't remember no romantic date, so now I'm thinking it was something I ate. I am a virgin and that ain't no joke. What's your stuff? You know, I think my holy water just broke.